Typically, when we say diversion, we're diverting service. There is an incredible amount of logic, and it's far more like a very complex game of Tetris and trying to weigh a lot of different variables to get the best outcome. Also recognizing fundamentally that time is precious and that trying to get something that's good so we can keep going, because if we spent 6 months to get the perfect plan, that also means we spent 6 months not doing this work.
To another episode of Spilling the Tea, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of the MBTA. I'm your host, Andrew Cassidy, of the MBTA's Customer and Employee Experience Department, and I'm excited to welcome Kat Benish, the MBTA's Chief of Operations Planning, Scheduling, and Strategy. In this episode, we step into the world of diversion planning, a crucial aspect of maintaining and enhancing our transit services. We'll discuss the intricate processes of diversion planning, including coordination with municipalities and the meticulous scheduling of shuttle and alternative services. Join us as we explore the strategic efforts that keep the MBTA moving forward, even when the tracks take a temporary detour. Please join me in welcoming Chief of Operations Planning, Scheduling, and Strategy, Kat Benish, to Spilling the Tea. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Now, to start, can you tell me a little bit about your role at the MBTA? What exactly does the Chief of Operations Planning, Scheduling, and Strategy do?
Great question. First of all, really excited to be here and talk about the T. So I've been the T for about 6.5 years, 5 years in this role. And the Chief of Operations Planning, Scheduling, Strategy, which I know is a mouthful. Basically, I like to think of it doing a lot of midterm strategy, really focusing on operations. Jokingly say the department OPSS, which I oversee, which is about 70 people, is the Dakota ring between operations and our administrative teams, and really focusing on the 6 month to 3 year timeframe of how do we improve and provide safe, reliable, and excellent service. That really oversees four key functions in the team. The first one is service planning and scheduling, which for folks who know transit is really like your bread and butter. It's a transit function. It's basically saying, hey, with the resources we have and the current conditions, whether they're on the roads or the tracks, what level of service, how frequently can the buses come, where do the buses go, how frequently do the trains go, what time do the trains go, and sort of those functions all the way down to all four rail lines and the buses. So that's service planning and scheduling. The other chief function is really more of our strategy work around bus, which is bus transformation, so bus network redesign and transit priority, and really trying to advance and transform our bus network to what it really needs to be and what we want it to be. I can also talk about that for hours. The third group is one that probably a lot of folks don't know about. It's very internally focused, and it's all about operations analytics and lean strategy and performance improvement and process improvement. And it's really about embedding with our rail operations and bus operations and control center leadership and helping giving them the data and the metrics and the tools they need to help provide service better every single day. And then the fourth team, which is why we're here today, is our contracted bus alternative service planning team, which is essentially every time we need to shut down the rail service or commuter rail service, how do we get passengers from point A to B? And how do we make sure that there are buses available for them if that's what we need to do? That in a nutshell is operations planning, scheduling, and strategy.
That is quite the nutshell. That is a very expansive role and responsibility with all those teams. As you mentioned, the reason that I really wanted to have you on the program today is to talk about diversions. We have plenty that have been happening already throughout 2024, and some of our listeners have already been reaching out, kind of looking for a little bit more insight into what diversions are. And speaking from the social space, I see the questions come in on a minute-by-minute basis for all the questions that they have. So for their benefit and for my benefit, could you please give us an overview of first what a diversion is and why they're essential for a transit system?
I think how we've been using them has really changed over the years too, and folks will probably see an ebb and flow to that. So a diversion, simply put, and I'm going to focus on rapid transits. We work on the commuter side time, but I think really focusing on rapid transit. A diversion is basically any time we are asking you, the passenger, to take a detour. And essentially, if you can see all the detour signs on a road, you have to go this way. You can't take your usual route. And that basically means that we're not running typically rail service between a point A to a point B. So, for example, just this February, we were running a diversion between Alewife to Harvard, which means we had no rail service between those two red line stations, and instead offered a shuttle bus between those stations and offered essentially other alternatives as well. So that's typically when we say diversion, we're diverting service. It comes in a lot of different flavors, though. And I realize when I do a lot of public meetings, the questions I often get is, well, what is a surge? How does a surge compare to a weekend? What is early access? And again, to get your question, why you're doing all this? And those are actually really related questions. So let me start with the definitions. So a surge, which I think is very much an MBTA term, and it's something I think we actually do need a better job to explain to folks, like what is that? A surge is basically any time we're shutting down the rail service during a weekday. I think the technical definition is like when it's a weekday plus a weekend from a purely taxonomy standpoint, but that's not really relevant here. But we think of that, and the reason we define it differently is because so much of our ridership is on the weekday, and that really requires a level of response that's different than, say, the weekend. So there's a surge, which means we're shutting down on a weekday. That's what we're doing right now on the Green Line. We've shut down parts of the B line, all of the C line, parts of the D line up into Copley for about 2 weeks. Weekend, I think, is very self-explanatory. We're doing the same thing, but on the weekend, we have less ridership. So it's usually not as disruptive to our customers, but we recognize it can be still quite disruptive as many people rely on transit on the weekend or choose to take it. And then finally, early access. And early access basically means typically that we are stopping rail service at 9 p.m. to the end of service, which is about 1, 2 in the morning. Sometimes that means we'll start a little earlier, like 8 p.m., and the reason we do all this work is essentially to enable track access. We need to get out onto the tracks to work on the tracks, fix, maintain, repair, sometimes do sort of smaller projects, and sometimes do sort of full-on, full-depth replacement of that track. And there's some things where you can imagine sort of like you're doing a home project, right? You're working in your kitchen, you're replacing, let's say, a cabinet. Currently working on my kitchen, so this is very top of mind, right? There's work you can kind of go in and do like 5 minutes now, 5 minutes later, and it doesn't really matter. That's when we'll do work on the overnight. It doesn't even impact service or early access where there's some impact because we want as much time as possible to work on the system. But there's work that you can do, you can imagine, where you actually have to take all the sort of the cabinet doors off. You have to take all the shelves out. You have to take all the stuff you have in the kitchens out, and you can't just put it back right away. And there's work that we do where actually once we're in there, we actually need multiple days in a row in order to be as effective as possible, because it could be on any given overnight between service stopping around 1, 2 in the morning and restarting at 5 in the morning. If you're taking it apart and putting it back every single night, the amount of time you have to actually work is very constrained, and you're actually not being nearly efficient as if you only take it apart once, work for 4 days, and then put it back together, you can spend most of your time actually doing the project you want to get done. And so when we think about, okay, we have the scope of work we want to do, we want to go replace floating slab. Folks who live on the Red Line know that very well, or go work on the speed restrictions in Ashmont. Anything that really typically touches the track, it's better both for the taxpayer and the rider that we actually get out there and do it all at once, because it means we're out there for 2 weeks rather than doing weekend after weekend after weekend after weekend for years. That's sort of a lot there, but essentially when you think about why we do it and essentially also what we're doing and how those two match together.
And it even reminds me a little bit of just general overnight work where, you know, at the end of service for the smaller projects that we get done, maybe painting a single cabinet door.
Yes.
I'll stick with your analogy. But, you know, the reality is that we're closed for such a short period of time. And a lot of the time that we're dealing with things, you know, it is that getting equipment into place and taking it off and getting everything ready before the start of service. So you really do have such a small window, and there's a lot more efficiency with those surge diversions, or sometimes I think I've seen them as full access diversions, where you really can just kind of own that space and really get things done in a efficient manner.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I think one thing we're also, and our head of capital engineering, Sam Zhao, I think has been a big proponent of this, as well as the GM and our COO, is a lot of other transit agencies do what's called single tracking. And the idea that you keep service running on one side, allowing you to work on the other side. I think WMATA does this very well. New York does this very well. But then we get into considerations of infrastructure, and that it's not necessarily an easy thing for the T to do for a number of physical limitations, but trying to figure out where and when we can do that so we limit these disruptions going forward.
That makes sense. And that's partially due to our being one of the older,
yes,
the oldest transit systems in the country, where we unfortunately didn't build dual tracks on every single spot back in the late 1800s. But
crossovers where you can turn around trains every 10 feet. Yeah, that would have been nice.
Yep.
When we get the time machine, Andrew.
That's it. So we've established the different types of diversions that we have. I guess my question is, how does the MBTA prioritize track repair work? What factors influence these decisions? And I'm going to go kind of a little bit higher level, which is, how does this all relate to the track improvement plan?
Great question. I was actually in a meeting last night, and I was asked, when they look at the track improvement program, which our GM put out in November, I believe, of 2023. This looks like you guys just threw a bunch of things against a dartboard. Like, please tell me there was logic. He's like, yes, there's an incredible amount of logic, and it's far more like a very complex game of Tetris and trying to weigh a lot of different variables to get the best outcome. Also recognizing fundamentally that time is precious. And that trying to get something that's good so we can keep going, because if we spent 6 months to get the perfect plan, that also means we spent 6 months not doing this work. And so particularly what went into the track improvement program, which is the plan that we're currently working to execute right now on, are about, I think we really officially start in November, we're about 4 months in. A couple of key factors. I think first and foremost is the track condition and understanding we being the collective agency, built an entire database to understand what is the condition of our track, how long has it been in this condition, and first and foremost, we say our system is safe. The reason, if we think there's any defects with the track, that's why we put on the speed restriction, and the speed restriction means that we go slower over those tracks. We're going over at a slow speed, which is a safe speed. So the tracks are safe, but by working and removing the speed restriction, we're able to go faster over the tracks, and thus obviously provide customers a faster and more reliable experience. But all the track defects are not all the same. And I'm getting well over my skis here, but essentially there was a process to figure out which are the defects most important to resolve first. That was sort of the first order. The second is recognizing it's somewhat orthogonal but related, is different speed restrictions have different impacts on customers. So there's some speed restrictions on the green line that were high priorities to fix. But once we remove them, there actually isn't really an impact on the customer, right? You're still going to be operating either maybe the speed restriction puts the train at 6 miles per hour. Once we remove the speed restriction, you can now operate at 10 miles per hour. To a customer in the downtown core, that difference is going to be imperceptible, though it's really important to us. So the second order for us was saying, hey, there's a whole bunch of speed restrictions that are important, but maybe moderate importance to get to when we think about the year. But when we remove them, rather than going 10 miles per hour on the red line, you can now go what's considered the line speed, or sort of your speed limit, which is 40 miles per hour.
Experienced that exact one. Yeah. I was on the last day before the diversion went into place to fix it, and I felt it. And I went on it, I think, maybe a week later, and night and day difference. It was like from 10 to 40, and you're going a long distance. So you do notice the time savings on something like that.
Yeah, and I'd say, I mean, to that point, the Ashmont line, we look a lot at the baseline speed. So we look at historically what's the fastest we've ever gone. The red line right now between Ashmont and JFK, we've actually set a new baseline. At least in my time of the T, it's never been that fast, which is great for our customers.
Excellent.
And obviously our operators. So those are the two main foundational stones of figuring out what we need to do and when. But that gives you a general sense of priority. Then we have to layer on the facts that we have to go out and do this work. So things that go into, okay, do we have the ability to do this work in February versus November, is essentially, do we have proper scopes? So before we're actually out there doing the work, there's a lot of work going on. We have our engineers, we have our contractors, we have leadership literally walking the tracks and inspecting, saying, okay, yes, this is the tie we need to replace. No, that doesn't need to replace. Hey, we also need to do X and Y, and make sure there's a really clear shared understanding of scope. Because when we're down there for 2 weeks, like say working the Green Line Tunnel, every minute is so important. So we want to make sure we have a really good plan going in on exactly what everyone is doing to make sure we actually get all that work done. So that requires a tremendous amount of work up front. And that's also why sometimes, like, it might seem sometimes we're bouncing around red line to orange line to blue line. And part of that is, well, from the prep work standpoint, we were ready to go with this piece, but not that piece till later. And then we also obviously have to procure the contracts, get contractors in, our Barlettas, our Middlesexes, our JF Whites, and making sure they also have the staff, resources, materials to do these projects. So that was a key component too of when we do what projects. And then finally, also because we're in the Boston region and we impact hundreds of thousands of people, we have to think about when are commencements, right? We're working, I think, red line branches during May. We try to avoid the green line during May. September is very challenging because of start of school. We won't work on Boston Marathon Day. We won't work on St. Patrick's Day, just because those are major, major days when we think about people traveling. We had to overlay that as well. So all those four things together essentially led to the plan that is out there right now of, like, why we're doing this work at this time in this order, trying to fundamentally better reduce that to, like, ensure the probability of success while also maximizing the results to our customers so they get the fastest trip possible as soon as possible.
So I guess somewhat related, how does piggyback work relate into this? obviously the priority is to address whatever, you know, issues have been identified as something that needs to be addressed. However, now you're going to be shutting down an area, and that does open up some opportunities for additional work that might not have the same need necessarily, but it actually has some sort of rider benefit. Can you speak to, I guess, how that process takes place when lighting is then improved at a station, when even realistically the main reason was to address track or something like that?
Yeah, no, happy to. And it's not my area of expertise, but I'll say sort of, again, seeing this from the alternative service side and planning side, is what has been great about the track improvement program is because not only have we been able to communicate to our customers and our municipalities and our sister agencies, hey, this is our plan. It also means we're able to communicate internally to all the projects because, again, we're an agency of over 6,500 people, give or take, and no one person can know every single plan that's out there. And so by putting that out there and very clearly and sticking to this plan, it allows our capital team to say, hey, you know what? Raise their hand. I've got an elevator project that I would love to go do at the same time we're doing X. Or to your point, the relighting. I don't know if folks have gone to Arlington. The stair treads at Arlington look phenomenal. And I highly recommend people who care about stair treads to go check them out because they look so good. And obviously station cleanup, we've gotten a lot of customer feedback that the lighting in Harvard looks amazing. And that's the piggybacking. And I think part of the reason we're able to do more of it and more effectively is because we've been able to communicate internally as well to our organization, to our frontline, to our engineers, to our designers that, hey, there's an opportunity coming up. That being said, though, track work will take precedent.
Of course.
And so if we can get in there, phenomenal. If we can't, hey, we understand that, but we're trying to get as much done at the same time as possible, but also being very clear internally that our track work will take priority and making sure we get that done first, because that's the reason for this and that's the reason for the disruption.
All right. So I'm learning, I'm going through the process of diversions. So being that it is part of your title slash department, I'd like to talk about the scheduling piece. So scheduling seems like a critical aspect for any diversion planning. How do you approach the scheduling of diversions? I know you touched on this a little bit already, but how do you approach that in a way that minimizes the impact on riders, and what factors are involved, you know, whether they're competing projects, what have you? What about the hours and days? What can you say about the actual scheduling component and all of the decisions that come in to say, like, you know what, whatever it is, April 23rd through the 30th, we're doing this, or July 19th through whatever is, we're doing this. How does that process take place?
Great question. And I think we are getting better and better at that. And I think one thing folks should be aware of is we actually just last September have set up a new team in the COO's office specifically to help manage the coordination between operations and capital. And whose sole job is, we call it to build the calendar, but it's much more complex and nuanced than that because it requires understanding the why we are doing projects. And so we can have those conversations of, you have both a project that wants to update our signals program going at the same time as, say, track inspection, which projects takes priority that weekend because you can't do everything and constantly trying to fit things in. I would say, and I think I've talked about before, the part that I'll say that's a little different is thinking about, we work very closely with our municipalities and we work very, very closely with our sister agencies, specifically MassDOT, as well as Massport, and ensuring that we've put out our plan, but there's still tons of other coordination that needs to happen. So, for example, working very closely with MassDOT to make sure we're thinking about Sumner Tunnel impacts and making sure they're aware of our track improvement program to make sure that there's so much work to be done out there. I know folks in the Boston area joke that we have fall, winter, spring, and construction season. And as a Somerville resident, I live that. But recognizing, trying to at least be very thoughtful about it. And then with municipalities, I feel like there's a 5K every single weekend and planning around that. Not necessarily planning around that, but again, I think fundamentally what I'm trying to say is there is a constant balance between, is there either another project or whether it's our project or a MassDOT project or such a large event that it means that we have to change our plan and do it on a different date? Or, and I think where we are now with the plan being out there is being very conscious and open and collaborative with our partners saying what's currently slated to happen so that we can plan around it. So we still will do it, but we'll change our shuttle route to avoid essentially a large conference. Or we work a lot with BU. They let us know when their major sporting events are. So we change where our shuttle buses are so they're not the same place as the student buses because they'll have a lot of buses out there for peak periods on the weekends. And then also fundamentally working very closely with the city of Boston, especially on utility work, making sure even just this last week, there was, I think, Eversource or National Grid in Kenmore and trying to like, we're doing the Green Line shuttle, but they're doing critical utility work. And how do we like real time collaborate? So I think the key point, it's not ever just sort of one and done. It's a constant level of collaboration at different levels of like, one, what's the big picture? Two, how do we optimize the plan? And then three, daily, real time, hour by hour conversations with the key partners to make sure operations are working. So it's a constant conversation and a constant dialogue.
And I think that's important to note that there is such collaboration. Again, seeing the tweets come in, I think there's some skepticism as to whether or not that happens, because there can be, you know, local realities that might be adverse to a shuttle or something that the MBTA is trying to do. Obviously, there's many, many players, many factors. People do need to be collaborative. But I guess what other ways are we working with municipalities, communities, whether at the government level to understand? I think I brought this back in a previous episode, but I remember during the Orange Line shutdown, I think we did ride-alongs with the city of Boston to also identify potential shuttle spots that, and we needed to make sure that they were accessible for people in wheeled mobility devices. So that was an interesting piece to see. What sorts of other partnership exists with municipalities, and then even maybe with the communities themselves when you're hearing directly from our riders?
Yeah. How long do you have, Andrew? And I mean, you live this just as much as I do, in some ways even more. So I'm sure I'm going to miss some things, but I'll speak to what I see. You're absolutely right. I mean, first and foremost, just the very tactical coordination with our cities. And I think we work most closely with Brookline and Boston and Cambridge right now, just based on where our diversions are. To give an example, just this Monday in the mid of the Green Line diversion, right, we had our vendors, our field staff down at Brookline Hills with the city of Brookline and I believe Brookline High School talking about how to work in that space, because last week was school vacation week. We didn't really have issues with pickup drop off. We do now, right? So actually getting out there with our constituents, with our major abutters, and talking through, okay, how are we going to get our buses in? Because we have the D-line trains coming to Brookline Hills and can unload, and you can have as many people as sort of four buses worth coming off at once. How do we get everyone onto buses, but also make sure people are getting to and from high school? I believe it's a high school there. So that level of collaboration, but for really all of our diversions, we will go out there with our city partners and walk through those trouble spots. And even if it's a diversion we've done before, we'll go out there again, just constantly based on feedback, trying to improve. I think the big one there that happened recently is for years when we shut down the Green Line core and we have our passengers divert to the Orange Line. The number one complaint that I'm sure you saw too is, why are you dropping me off at Copley? I don't want to walk to Back Bay. And folks who don't live that experience or see Google Maps be like, gosh, that's super close. That shouldn't be an issue. But the grade, the slope is pretty steep. And folks who have any sort of impairment or use a wheeled mobility device like really struggle, because the curb cuts are actually quite challenging too. So we worked with Boston closely, and even up to, I want to say, like, embarrassingly, a day before the diversion went live, we were still trying to figure it out how to get our buses to Back Bay. The curb space is very narrow, so we had to work through a lot of different plans, but we got it. And so we moved the shuttle stop from Copley to Back Bay, which again may not feel like a lot to some folks, but for our riders, it was a really, really big deal. And it just took a lot of collaboration, because that requires Boston closing streets, eliminating like right turn lanes, getting police details out there, changing signals, putting up no parking signs. Again, a lot of things go into that. Folks often say, hey, why don't you just do a pop-up bus lanes? Like, we love those. I would love to have more pop-up bus lanes. We're trying to figure out how that is. But sometimes just changing the timing on a traffic signal can be just as positively impactful to our riders as a pop-up bus lane.
It's great to hear. And it's not just that you're collaborating, but you're trying to continually innovate and improve on that rider experience, which I suppose also brings me to my next question, which I think you're starting to jump into, which is, what strategies are the MBTA using to minimize the disruption to riders during all of these diversions, and especially with so many slated for 2024, you know, shuttle and alternative service are vital during diversions, but how does the MBTA ensure that these services are efficient and adequately mitigate the impact to riders in an accessible way?
Yeah. I mean, and that's the reason for being, right? That's why our team existing, and that's why we're growing our team currently from 2 to 9 people that focuses on this. And again, this is just one piece. I think first and foremost, and that's where we work really closely with obviously your team, Andrew, is communication, right? I think it's been really interesting just watching our customers. I think there's been an education there process. I think especially when we see our Green Line, Orange Line riders say maybe 2 years ago weren't as comfortable switching between the two. And I think now folks are very aware that those actually parallel quite closely, and you can get back and forth between the two. And in case anyone asks, like, well, why don't you just shuttle the downtown? I promise you, putting you a shuttle downtown Boston is going to be way worse than getting on the orange under the green line. We get that question a lot, and we hate shuttling downtown Boston because we just cannot provide a good experience. And so the first and foremost is, in many ways, we think of bus shuttles as the last resort. Mm. Our goal is try to do everything, rely on our existing system as much as possible. So we will push people to rapid transit, so the orange and the green. As we try to build capacity experience, we're trying to get a lot better about predicting capacity. And so right now, for folks realizing currently on the green line, only the E line is running through the core. We did a lot of analysis to understand. So typically in the green line core, you get a headway, or what we call time between trains, every 2 to 3 minutes. If we're just running the E line, we found that we were actually only able to do every 5 to 6 minutes, which was leading to situations where we actually had 40% less capacity. And we were able to model out and say, hey, we're going to expect some very serious crowding between these hours and obviously AM peak and PM peak. And that led to working with Green Line Ops, essentially, that we're running during the peak of the peak. Green Line Operations, the folks who run the trains, are actually sort of running 3 extra trains at the peak of the peak to help clear with that crowding. And so again, fundamentally, what I'm saying here is one of the things we're getting better and better at is A, using alternative options, the rapid transit. We also work very closely with the commuter rail team. Can they make their trains longer so there's more capacity? Can they occasionally run additional trains? There's challenges with that, but we're trying to do that more. But then also understand, rather than just say, hey, go take this system instead, making sure there's actually room on those trains, room on those buses, so that you're not showing up to another system or something you're not familiar with and actually having a bad experience as well. And then also, fundamentally, we spend a lot of time with the shuttles themselves. We know we're going to still run bus shuttles, making sure the routes are accessible and fast. And that's where we work very closely with the municipalities and doing the walkthroughs and drive-throughs. And I think we are getting more comfort with municipalities about actually setting up those like pop-up bus lanes, setting aside additional space for the stops so there's more queuing. And again, we actually spend a lot of time with signals and turning lanes. Just again, because we find that if you're ever in a shuttle and you see like one bus behind another bus behind another bus, what's probably really happened is the signal timing isn't working in our favor. And we get buses basically just stacking up one behind another because it takes longer for a coach bus or a low floor bus, like a transit bus, to get through an intersection. And so, again, you wouldn't think it as people who run the shuttles, but we spend a lot of time talking about traffic signal timing. But then where we can, trying to do pop-up bus lanes are great because it means you can go faster. But the real beauty of bus lanes is actually means they're more reliable since there's less variation from going from point A to point B.
Makes a lot of sense. And it also makes sense, kind of similar to how, unfortunately, in 1897 or what have you, we didn't have the foresight to double track. The reality is a lot of our downtown core streets are original and were designed for, you know, maybe two-way traffic with horses. But for modern vehicles, unfortunately, especially with a bus, all those one-way streets makes it really difficult. So that does make a lot of sense as to why the core is a little unique in that regard.
What we'd love to do, too, in conversations with cities is, and this is the beauty of overseeing both the alternative service team and the transit priority team and the bus network redesign team, is saying, okay, hey, is there something we can test out now that we're actually working with municipalities to go build? And in some cases, I think we've seen that. So during the Orange Line shutdown, right, there's still some bus lanes out there that I think sort of allowed us to test pilot as part of the diversion that have gone on to also work for our bus riders. Because as much as we're trying to get a good experience on the roads for our rail riders, we got to make sure we also are trying to improve the experience for our bus riders too.
Absolutely. I'm multimodal. So I take the bus, commuter rail, and rapid transit pretty much every week, if not every day. So it's good when all of them work well together.
Right?
No, I feel you for that one. Are there any other kind of interesting tests or things that have worked, or even things that maybe we learned where like, hey, maybe this is going to work out really well? And it's like, well, that was good in my head, but in application, it didn't really work out. Just out of curiosity, since you brought it up.
Oh, that's a good question. I think we are still trying to better understand how to leverage our existing bus network for diversions. And I think the comment we always get is, well, can't you just run more buses on a bus route? I wish we always could, but it is challenging because those are sort of set. Folks clearly know our challenges with manpower and operations and bus operations. That is changing, which is super exciting, which kind of opens up that door. And it means that potentially we can start trying to add more service to bus routes. But then we also have to look carefully. I always think of diversions. I think people think about like their system or their mode of like, it's a tube. Like you get on here, you get off there. But I think of our transit service really like almost fluid dynamics in rivers. You basically turn off one spigot, it goes elsewhere. And getting better about predicting what people choose instead.
I like this analogy a lot.
Thank you. It's cool. I've been
working on it. I'm going to use this somewhere.
We actually have an award-winning, industry-leading origin destination model here at the MBTA. It's called ODX, Origin Destination. But yeah, if you're in WMATA, right, you have to tap out. You get on LaFont, you get off at Union, we know exactly where you went. Here, we don't know because you don't tap out. So some very smart people in the MBTA and over at Mass.org at OPMI essentially created a model that predicts where you go. And we're trying to use that more to figure out, okay, if we shut down the red line between Alewife and Harvard, what are you going to go do? And so we looked really closely at our bus routes during this last diversion. And not surprisingly, we saw a lot of ridership on the 77, which parallels the red line. So that makes lots of sense. People just picked it up. It was easy. It carried them where they needed to go. But we actually saw less ridership on the route one, which is surprising because that's always been our hypothesis that people would shift to the route one. So we need to dig a little more into that. But I think as we expand and get better, I'm hoping that as we get more bus operators and can start potentially beefing up bus service, or one of the advantages of the bus network redesign, too, is that we'll have twice as many frequent routes that allow it, again, to be a really viable alternative to rapid transit during rail diversions, is we can better understand the decisions people are going to make so we can better serve them. And then the places that's like really, really out there that I'm really excited about, too, is how we think about active transportation. And one thing here at the T, we've recently hired someone to think about like the role of active, like bikes and pedestrians and how we like create that last mile, first mile access. I think one thing that we've been trying to think about too is recognizing that we run buses and trains. How do we better interact with bike and pedestrian during these diversions? Yep. Even if it's just communication to let folks know all the different options that exist to them.
One thing that I think you hinted at a little bit, and it relates to, I guess, previous conversations I've had. How does operator availability? It's well known that the MBTA and transit as a whole, they were struggling with hiring for a while. Mm. We've made some tremendous strides, you know, starting in 2023. We're, you know, on a positive trajectory. But how does that operator availability or even just personnel availability, how does that impact diversions and, I guess, mitigation of impact on riders?
Yeah. So that's
big question.
Big question and like really interesting question. It kind of goes back to one of your first questions too. So our general stance is if we can use our operators and our buses for a replacement shuttle, it is always our preference. We love our buses. We think we have the best training in the nation of bus operators. And it's fundamentally like we are very, very appreciative of our private partners. They are phenomenal, but we would prefer to use our own resources. So currently, and this has been something we've always talked about, and again, wasn't really possible until we fixed bus operator hiring, which I totally agree. We're in a phenomenal trend right now. I'm so excited for this year. It's awesome. Is that all shuttles are done on overtime. So a bus operator will work their regular work. They'll drive the route one a week. And then on the weekend, maybe they pick up two shifts of overtime and they'll do a shuttle. That can be challenging if we're short operators. That means instead our operators might be picking up a shift or two to actually cover what we'd call our scheduled work. Like the 77 driver wasn't there today, so can you do that work instead? So there's less what we call that overtime availability to put towards shuttles. That is changing. I think our drop trips right now are like 1.5%, which is still above our policy of we should only be dropping, I think, 1 in 200 trips. So we're doing about what, 3 in 200 trips right now. But what that means is that we'll have more operators and means we should be able to, over time, shift more diversion work on the weekends, at least, to MBTA resources, which is where we want to be. We won't get into too much, but if we do early access, that's evening. Again, that's easier to time and overtime. I think the two factors that we're trying to think through are, one, as long as we're doing those weekday surges, which, again, are really valuable for getting a lot of work done. And also, we didn't talk too much about it, but every time you set up or take out a diversion, you need a lot more resources, right? You need your power linemen. You need all your track crew. You need to basically set things up. They may not be the ones doing the work, but you need like a surge of resources at the beginning of the end. And one of the other advantages of those weekday surges is it's not as resource demanding on a large part of the organization, again, which allows us to do more work. But the challenge of the weekday surges is that we need our bus operators to go provide, like drive the Route 1, drive the 77, like drive the 230. which means they're not even available for overtime to do surges. So as long as we're doing weekday surges, we'll probably depend on our outside vendors. The one thing that folks may remember that's been talked about in the past is called FlexForce. And I think it's a broader conversation about MBTA hiring is, do we ever want to shift to a model where we actually have staff like fully dedicated to essentially doing the work related to capital, whether that's in our engineering maintenance department or whether that's our bus operators. But that's obviously tied up in much larger conversations about workforce management, being able to do level loaded planning, and thinking obviously the broader financial conversation of the MBTA.
So we know that that could be kind of an impact for diversions, but what are some of the other challenges in the scheduling and implementing of diversions, and how do you address them? I know we've talked a whole bunch. So you're working with the city up until the last moment, right before the thing goes live. You're working with operator shortage or availability. What other challenges kind of are there for you and your team that you have to overcome to actually make a successful diversion?
So I think there's two issues, one specifically to my team, one to the organization. So the first one is fundamentally capacity. And I think the organization is doing a phenomenal job. But recognizing, let's say a decade ago, we were doing, oh gosh, don't quote me, but what, $700, $800 million worth of capital work a year. We're doing nearly or over $2 billion a year. And if you look at the track improvement plan too, right, it's not one diversion, one surge, then 2 months later, it's another surge, but it's back to back to back, which we know is a lot on our customers and riders, but it's also a lot on staff. And it means that our processes have to change. That while we're executing, we need to be both doing a retrospective on the last one and then looking ahead to the next one. And that's just a fundamentally different way of working. And like, I really applaud the team. I think we've made a lot of org changes and process changes to help cope with that. But it does mean that everyone's being asked to do a lot of different processes at once. That's definitely one challenge that we're working through. And I think, again, customer experience, you guys have been doing a great job, I think, really leading a lot of that too, when we think about our comms. Internally, getting technical, I think one of the biggest challenges too, both in understanding, responding, and communicating, is I think historically there's been a mindset that the diversion is from point A to point B and there's no other impacts on the system. And that's just not the case. And getting better about communicating expectations and options to folks who are impacted downstream. So a great example is, again, that Alewife to Harvard surge. That means, though, we have to turn around trains at Harvard. Harvard wasn't constructed to really be a terminal station. So it means currently, I think we can turn around trains at Alewife, let's say every 4 to 5 minutes. Don't quote me on exactly that, but that's roughly how it is. At Harvard, it takes about 10 minutes to turn around a train all in. And so what this meant is currently our red line headways, or again, time between trains, were previously 8 minutes outside of the diversion, which means it's every 16 minutes, just multiply by two for your time between trains on the branches. When we did the diversion at Harvard, it meant that the headways became every 10 minutes in the core and every 20 minutes the branches. So our Ashmont riders, who may not have paid any attention to what's going on at Harvard or Alewife, are suddenly impacted. And that's probably a lesser case because it's a 2 to 4 minute diversion. But there's other diversions, especially if we go down single tracking, where it actually may be significantly more. And I think one thing that we're really trying to get better at is understanding that and really communicating that in a way that folks understand and help them make better choices about how they're going to travel. That's definitely been one of our challenges. I think one thing we've been trying much harder this year to do so, just because it's something historically I don't think we've done the best at.
The education piece is obviously something that's near and dear to our hearts and something that we're trying to do on the daily to help our riders understand. So I'm going to challenge you now with hopefully a tidbit of education, because we are very frequently asked, when will these diversions end? And can you answer that and help us, I guess, suppose, understand the answer to when they will end and just understanding that process?
It's a great question. And I'll also give us a quick anecdote too of like, I realize how challenging it is. It's like, one, I travel the system every day with a toddler. So like, it's really hard navigating the system, especially when you're changing. Though I will say my son was the only one, I think, on the train who was upset when the green line surge ended, because he really liked the orange line trains. And so he'd cry at North Station every day when we weren't getting on the orange line trains. So I'd explain, like, it's, trust me, it's great that it's a one seat ride now. Obviously 2024, it's public, it's out there, we're going to do it. I don't know the answer to that, but I'll give two thoughts again from my time here at the T, what I've seen, and sort of trying to draw two thoughts. One is the state of good repair backlog. Folks know it. I think we're now over $20 billion. Two-thirds of our assets are past their useful life. And what that means is we still have a lot of work ahead of us. But I don't want that to necessarily terrify our riders either, because I think on the flip side, let's go back to that single tracking and the broader question of staffing at the tee. I think that we are very much in a crucible right now going through the track improvement program, but at the same time, trying to learn as much as possible so that we're getting smarter about how to do this work with less impact. So there's going to be some level of diversions forever. If someone has an idea about how to do it without that, let me know. Love to know it. But I think where we're trying to be better is how do we do this in a way that is less impactful to customers? So whether that's single tracking, whether that is finding ways to get more, we call that wrench time on overnight, whether it's finding ways to do more work during revenue that's less impactful to customers so that we can tackle this work in a way that is less disruptive. So I think the answer is there's still a lot of work ahead of us, but I think we're trying to also evolve the way we work. And I think actually the final thing out of there is, and we didn't really talk about the question of like, why are diversion limits what they are? Like, why do you go from Alewife to Harvard? And there's a whole bunch of factors. We just finished a project that we're now trying to include into our capital plan of, are there things we can do, like putting in a crossover, which is basically like where you turn around trains or changing up the power sections because you have to turn the power off to go do work. Can we shorten those, right? So can we make it that rather than doing Alewife to Harvard, could we do Alewife to Davis, right? Or could we do just Oak Grove to Malden Center rather than Oak Grove to Sullivan Square, right? So that we're still doing work, but we're trying to better match where we're doing work to where folks are being impacted. So I think what we're really doing is how do we work smarter going forward? That I think is the big challenge for the T for when it relates to diversions in 2024 and into 2025.
And even like vehicle access points can determine that too, where I remember having to go, I think I was getting on the right of way on the blue line and learning that there was a road I didn't even know existed over by airport, which is like the primary access point to get equipment on, which again, even if the work isn't happening at airport, I think it was for the tunnel. But, you know, you had to go all the way back a couple of stops to do that because you can't just drop it into the sea and hope it lands in the tunnel or something like that. So
yeah,
that makes a lot of sense.
I mean, that's exactly it. Like it may not be obvious, but like you think about ants going into an anthill, like near those points of entry, that's sometimes what it looks like. The sheer amount of equipment we're bringing in and out, ballast.
Yep.
You need those track pad accesses. And I think especially for Blue Line riders and Red Line riders on the north side, that has been really an Achilles heel for us for a while that we're trying to remedy.
I mean, like I said, it's nice to hear that there's an awareness and a desire to improve and that so much is already underway and pretty much everything is on the table as far as innovation to making this a more efficient and less impactful to riders as possible. I guess, you know, speaking of riders, my final question for you is, what advice do you have for our riders in order to best navigate the system during all these planned diversions for 2024?
Yeah, that's a hard one. Fundamentally, obviously, thank you for your patience and understanding. Again, I ride the system every single day. I have been directly impacted by all these diversions. And it's, again, funny, too, that there are a few people in the organization, I think, who know at least the timing and the cadence of the diversions more than I do. And yet there are definitely days when a diversion starts and I go out there, even though I literally the day before was out doing site visits.
Yep.
I get on the tee and I'm like, oh, right, this happens today. And sort of like those silos and sort of coming to reality with that. Fundamentally, I think it is appreciation of patience, understanding why the work is being done. I think most people I've talked to have been really understanding and very supportive. And again, like you said, those Red Line riders down in Ashmont, they see it and they feel the difference and they understand sort of hopefully the goodwill that we're building. And if I could be a little flip, I think too, there's an opportunity for folks to learn the system more. I think speaking to some riders down the Mattapan area who were in the Ashmont-Mattapan surge, we made the Fairmont line free during that diversion as a way to encourage people to take the Fairmont line. Because if you're coming from Mattapan, it's going to be a much better trip to get on the Fairmont line rather than hopping on a shuttle, even an express. And the number of people who said, I had never taken the commuter rail before, but this is actually now my preferred commute was awesome, right?
One shift can be scary.
Yeah, but if we can make it easier, and same thing for people like, I never knew this bus route existed, but it actually takes me door to door. So there's a silver lining to it too, to like try out the system and just realize all the different places it can take you. Though I realize that if we're running a diversion, you may not be happy about it, but thank you for understanding and thank you for patience and know that I'm probably sitting right next to you, especially if you're on the green line.
Thank you so much, Kat, for your time and for hopefully helping our listeners understand the intricacies of diversion planning, scheduling, and all that goes into it. that it is a well thought out process and that there's so much more to be done. But thank you for educating me in the process as well.
No, thank you. This was a pleasure. Really fun. And just, yeah, I think the biggest thing for me is that it's not a single person. It's a team, many teams, and that we know we need to get better and we're constantly trying to get better, both for the organization and the community.
Well said. Thank you again.
As we wrap up, I want to thank Kat for the valuable insights she shared today. It's clear that diversion planning is a cornerstone in maintaining and upgrading our transit system. Kat has given us a deeper understanding of the complexities and meticulous planning that go into ensuring minimal disruption while carrying out necessary work. From setting strategic diversion limits to collaborating with municipalities and scheduling alternative services, every step is integral to keeping the region moving smoothly. To our listeners, thank you for tuning in to Spilling the Tea. Today's topic was requested by multiple listeners, so if you have a suggestion for future topics, be sure to reach out to us at social@mbta.com. We'll continue to bring you a behind-the-scenes look at the MBTA and shed light on the work that keeps our communities connected. Remember to stay informed about upcoming diversions by subscribing to Tea Alerts, visiting our website, and by following us on social media. Until next time, I'm Andrew Cassidy, and this has been Spilling the Tea.